We live. We fight. And we die. For each other. Not for you.
Tootin', boy, happy days are here again because it's crumbling. This whole rotten system is crumbling and the snake is eating its tail. Now, you know, we used to think like these militia guys would go out there and confront them head on. And somehow the baby Jesus was going to come down and win it for us. But we learned the hard way. That's not the way it works. The best way is the slow way. The slow revolutionary way. That works out. A few years ago, I got off on a skinhead situation. Well, we met a lot of good kids in the skinhead situation. But we met a lot of bad ones, too. And, 25 years ago, I said, let's close this down and grow your hair out, wear normal clothes, go to college, get a degree, and get into something you can really do some good for the white race, especially science. And, of course, all phases, you know, we got people that have, over the years, gotten into the federal system and so forth. Now a lot of them have been there for a couple of decades. And but the reason they survive is because they don't talk. They don't talk about their racial beliefs. They don't have flags all over their houses. And they don't have all the things that we used to think was pretty cool. And they don't call me on the telephone. And they don't send me a bunch of letters and stuff. Because they're lone wolves, and they're there. And as time goes on, they will be very much extremely important to the survival of the people, to the white people. And the federales know that, but they can't do anything about it. That's what's funny. They don't want to even talk about what I'm talking about. They're not saying, oh, did you hear what Metzger said? He told them to shut up, be quiet, don't join any organizations, don't do any of that bullshit, stay out of drugs, all that stuff. You know, get an education, burrow into the system as far as you can burrow in, and keep your old mouth shut, even if you have to pretend you're something you're not. Oh, I love those nigger boys. Yeah, I love those nigger boys, yeah. They should get all that. They should get money and all kinds of stuff. Government should give them everything they want because they deserve it. Their great 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 granddaddy was a slave. Yeah, you play that game. I've had guys years ago were playing that game working for the city of L.A. They plant all kinds of stuff out there. The blacks would love them, you know, on the job because they thought they were on their side. But for the long run, they weren't on their side. They were only on our side. Black people got to be on their side. White people got to be on our side. That's the way it works. And any black person that has any brains is going to be a black separatist, similar to Malcolm X. Not like Martin Luther King. He was a race-mixing son of a bitch. He loved to screw white women, boy, I'll tell you that. Yeah. Hey, this is Terrible Tommy in the Bunker today. And it's the 27th of January, 2016. And it's Woden's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Special day, Wotan. You know, I told you a couple of weeks ago that somebody sent me a really cool calendar. And it's put together by political prisoner KWM. And I don't know who that is. And I don't necessarily need to know who it is. But every month has got all these pictures of our departed soldiers of the racial struggle. This month it was Eric Banks was given tribute on the first day of the month. It's got his picture. They got pictures of everybody in here. John Sanger was on the 6th birthday. Gordon Call, born on the 8th. And on the 14th was Michael Westerman, who died in 1995, probably murdered by Negroes. 16th is White Unity Day. Robert J. Matthews, born in 1958. And then on the 17th is White Separatist Day. And the 18th is James Earl Ray Day. Got a picture of some of the family, some of the Ray family. And on the 19th, General Robert E. Lee, born in 1807. And the 20th was Gene Craig, born 33. Gene Craig was the only female active member in the order crew. And she did about 20 years, I think, in federal prison. And Byron De La Beckwith, one of the head guys in the 50s Klan, gutsy guy. He's on the 21st of January. And Dorothy Miles, Bob Miles' wife, was born on the in 1929 on the 24th day of January. And interestingly enough, Robert J. Miles was my good friend. They both were good friends of mine for years. And Robert Miles was born in 1925 on the 28th. That's coming up tomorrow. And if you have the calendar, you'll see a picture of Robert Miles and yours truly on the page there, shaking hands. I'm proud of that picture. And then on the 30th, for all you people that are really into Uncle Adolf, Hitler was appointed chancellor in 1933. So each month I'll read these off some one day of the month for you. And, oh yeah, I want to tell you where you can get this calendar. It's a beautiful thing. We put out several calendars over the years, but none of them were this fancy. We even got living color here. So you write to A Soldier's Path, P.O. Box 8073, Springfield, Missouri, 65801. or they've got a website, www.cisprisonoutreach.com. And to email these people, a.soldiers.path@gmail.com. I think everybody should have one of these calendars and keep track of things. There's not enough tribute given to the people who fought and died and been in prison and everything else. That's why one of the things I condemn most of the right wing for. They never pick up their wounded. If they do anything that is a little out of the ordinary, they condemn them too. You know, you don't see the blacks doing that. They write them in prison almost no matter what they do. They give them tribute. That's right. The right wing always amazed me. They advocate all kinds of stuff. All kinds of violence and everything else, and we got to get them, and we got to rise up, and we got to do it, and we got to do this, and we got to do that. But then when any of the people do it, forget it. They relegate them to obscurity. They don't write them in prison. They don't send them any money. Incidentally, I picked up 4 money orders today to send to 4 POWs. So we'll get that done today. Now, for all you people out there that say Obama never does anything good, which nobody does everything bad all the time, he's wanting to get these kids out of solitary confinement, putting young prisoners in solitary confinement. Now they're beginning to expand the dialogue about adults, who are put into solitary confinement for decades sometimes, years. Some of our people are in solitaries because of their racial views. And about anybody who expresses racial views gets tossed in solitary. So that's one thing Obama's done good. And when somebody does something good, I don't care who they are, I'm going to give them credit for it. I think they're talking about pulling about 6,000-7,000 youthful offenders out of solitary confinement. Some of you Sharpies out there may have noticed I made a boo-boo yesterday. I was taking some information off the web. I forget what on now, but another story popped up right behind it from, I think it was CBS, I don't know which, was about the militants getting into the naval station out in San Diego, and I thought it was current news. It was old news, because I looked all over the news last night. There was nothing about it. I said, shit, I put the wrong thing on there. Plus, now this morning there was came on the radio about the radio about Trump giving an interview to a magazine back in 1998, where he said everybody should vote Republican because they're the dumbest people on earth, or something like that. And that was back when I guess he was a Democrat. Well, a guy called in on the radio and told him moderator that, and the moderator got all excited and was going to put it out, but he checked it out. It's fake. I sent it out to you this morning. I thought that was too good to be true. Yeah. Well, here's another one of those asshole reporters wanting an interview.
My name is Doug Kenny Crispin, and I'm a co-producer of the radio program podcast series Kick-Ass Oregon History. We are a program that looks at exciting events in Oregon's past. Our broadcasts are aired on Portland, in Portland on 107.1 FM or X-Ray.FM. I've been featured on OPB's Portland Noir, working on the public art project at Erickson Fritz Building. And in July, KAOH was voted by the Willamette Weekly readers
as 2015's runner-up for Best Portland Podcast. I did know one guy that was pretty decent. He was pretty friendly to me from the Willamette Weekly, but the rest of them weren't. 2016 will find us releasing a 10 to 12 episode season that we're calling Policing in Oregon. Well, you're only interested in the problem of policing when it affects the progressives, not racial people. This series will progress sequentially, starting at the 1820s Oregon and proceeding to the modern era. We will be interviewing area experts, including historians, police officers, citizens, activists, others. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales has sat down with us, and I'm interviewing former police chiefs. Well, that's where to get the truth. I'll tell you what, the way they lied in my civil trial up there. I wanted to see if you would be willing to sit down and chat with me as well so I can come back and hammer the hell out of you over the telephone. Specifically, I want to talk to you about the 80s and 90s skinhead, white supremacist movement in the Pacific Northwest. The killing of Milagetas Araw and the resulting trial here in Portland. My trial. As a historian, not a reporter, I wanted to get your opinions on these subjects. And I think you have a very unique view on these subjects that many of our listeners haven't been exposed to. Let me know if this is something that you would like to chat about. I do appreciate your consideration. Have a great day, Dougie. Well, I've gotten to the point in my life I just don't like to give any interviews. They never turn out the way you... I mean, they never tell the truth. I mean, it's not that... they just don't do it. No matter how truthful you are, they slant the story another way. So I don't think I'll be doing this interview. I wonder if they're going to tell about how Negroes were not allowed into Oregon at all up until after the 40s. Actually, Oregon was more racist than Mississippi. So anyhow... Well, we'll see. But if they're interviewing all the cops, they're going to interview the cops about the trial in Portland, and they'll lie through their teeth just like they perjured through their teeth at the time of the trial. So anyhow, so much for that. Well, today I'd like to do a little traveling through a book that I received from a young man who did it for his doctorate. His name was Joseph C. Sciambra, and he did this book together, From Herbert Spencer to Alfred Schultz, Jack London, His Library, and the Rise of Radical Racialism in the Turn of the Century America. So chapter one, Jack London, born in the age of Herbert Spencer. In June of 1899, Jack London wrote a letter to Caudesley Johns, his friend and intellectual pen pal, concerning the various human races, in which he was quoted as saying, "Know that the Welsh blood is really no nearer, save geographically, and no further away from the Anglo-Saxon than is the Hindu blood of India or the Iranic of Persia. The Welsh, of which breed were the Welsh kings you mention, belongs to the Celtic branch of the Aryan family, as the pure Russian does to the Slavonic, the Hindu and the Persian to the Indo-Iranic, all the same family but distinctly different branches." The contents of this letter demonstrates that London, at the age of 23, already possessed a remarkable knowledge regarding philosophic trends in racial ideology. Jack London's life coincided with the resurgence of racism in the mid-19th century and the emergence of radical racism in Europe and the United States. the writings of racists from Herbert Spencer to Charles Woodruff played an enormous role in forming London's views on race, while racists from Germany to California sang the praises of the genetically superior Aryan race. Only one major literary figure joined them in their chorus. He was Jack London. Herbert Spencer was born in Derby, England, on April the 27th, 1820, to a Quaker father and a Methodist mother. As a child, Herbert Spencer inclined himself towards self-education. This aspect of Spencer's life repeated itself in the lives of many of his later followers. The unconventional religious beliefs of Spencer's parents instilled in him the disregard of authority. Never enrolled in a university, Spencer received the equivalent of a high school education under the tutelage of his uncle at Hinton Charterhouse near Bath. With a penchant for reading romantic adventure novels, the young Spencer never followed through with his interest in the natural sciences. Before writing his first book, Spencer's resume included a position as assistant schoolmaster, an engineer with the Birmingham and Gloucester Railway, and an assistant editor with a suffragist newspaper. 26 years before the birth of Jack London, and 9 years before the publication of Charles Darwin's On the Origins of Species in 1859, in his Social Statics, or The Conditions Essential to Human Happiness Specified, and the first of them developed, Spencer wrote this: "Whilst the continuance of the old predatory instinct, after fulfillment of its original purpose, has retarded civilization by giving rise to conditions at variance with those of social life, it has subserved civilization by clearing the earth of inferior races of men. The forces which are working out the great scheme of perfect happiness, taking no account of incidental sufferings, exterminate such sections of mankind as stand in their way, with the same sternness that they exterminate beasts of prey and herds of useless ruminants. Be he human being or be he brute, the hindrance must be gotten rid of." Sounds pretty radical to me. Spencer anticipated his own theory of survival of the fittest in Social Statics. Later in The Principle of Biology, 1864 to 1867, he thoroughly explained the phrase that made him famous. Spencer's survival theory gave rise to the social Darwinist movement and later contributed to the development of radical racism. It was Spencer's belief in the inheritance of acquired characteristics, not Darwin's theory of natural selection, which exerted the greatest influence on racist theory, especially upon American racists. Between the years of 1860 and 1903, Herbert Spencer, father of social Darwinism, sold 368,755 copies of his various works in the United States. In the preface of the 1865 edition of Spencer's First Principles, Edward L. Yeomans wrote, quote, "If we are not mistaken, it is in America that Mr. Spencer is to find his largest and fittest audience." When Spencer visited the United States in 1882, his reception rivaled those usually reserved for European royalty. In a rare interview during his stay in New York City, Spencer stated this, quote, "It may, I think, be reasonably held, both because of its size and its heterogeneity of its components, that the American nation will be a long time in evolving its ultimate form, but that its ultimate form will be high. One great result is, I think, tolerably clear, from biological truths, it is to be inferred that the eventual mixture of the allied varieties of the Aryan race forming the population will produce a finer type of man that hitherto has existed. With Spencer's statement in 1882, the history of radical racism officially began. Though Spencer frequently used the term Aryan, he often connected its usage with Max Müller's linguistic terminology. Who were the Aryans? According to Spencer, the Aryan race consisted of the Scandinavian races, which included Norwegians, Swedes, Danes, Germans, Dutch, and Anglo-Saxons. Also included were the Celts and the Southern Europeans. Great distinctions existed between the subdivisions of the Aryan race, but even higher differences existed between the Aryans and those of Mongolian or Negro stock. Nearly 17 years later, a young would-be writer wholly agreed with Spencer's statement. In the same 1899 letter to Klodowski, Johns, Jack London described how all the bloods which go into the makeup of modern Anglo-Saxon, all are allied as shoots of the same branch of the Aryan family. Where did a man whose academic career could best be described as inconsistent gain such knowledge? The story began in the Oakland Public Library a decade before. In 1876, at the height of Spencer's popularity in the United States, Flora Wellman Cheney, the abandoned wife of a San Francisco astrologer, gave birth to a son. Later that year, Flora married John London. London's wet nurse, a local Negro woman named Virginia Prentice, remained close to her white child throughout her life, though Jack London would later color his childhood with tales of abject poverty. His circumstances were far better if compared with many other working-class youths. The Londons often lived on a shoestring, but the children, London and his two stepsisters, rarely went hungry. Unlike many of other children of the day, London graduated from grammar school because he was never forced to abandon his studies for a factory job. London's first exposure to racial theories came from his mother and, ironically, Virginia Prentice, the black woman. He wrote of his mother, quote, "She steadfastly maintained that brunettes and all the tribe of dark-eyed humans were deceitful." But Virginia maintained that the Negro race was superior. These mixed messages from two most influential women from his childhood may have sparked his early interest in Spencer and racial theory. Also, London's relationship with Prentice may account for his unusual silence concerning Negro Americans. A vociferous reader, the books in the library of the adult London included such diverse titles as Frederick Engels' Landmarks of Scientific Socialism and Francis Parkman's The Oregon Trail, Sketches of Prairie and Rocky Mountain Life, 1872. As a child, London haunted the Oakland Free Public Library. Two of London's favorite books from his childhood were Paul de Chaillu's African Travels, 1861, and Ouida's Horatio Alger modeled story called Cigna, 1875. The boys' books London read as a child laid the foundation on top of which Spencer's later racial philosophies were built. In The Valley of the Moon, 1913, Saxon Roberts, the heroine of the novel, forced by dire economic conditions and imprisonment of her scabashed husband, sought solitude at the Oakland waterfront. There she meets a boy of about 12 or 13 named John, who prefers to go by the name Jack. Not only does the young Jack boast of a pure Anglo-Saxon ancestry, but tells of his visits to the free library. The boy's favorite authors are Manly Robert Michael Ballantyne, Captain Frederick Marriott and Captain Maine Reed. When Saxon admits to never reading their books, Jack cries, "And you, an Anglo-Saxon?" Indeed, the books written by these authors touted the superiority of the white man. In Ballantyne's The Coral Island, written in 1858, one member of the group of shipwrecked boys deserted on a South Sea island states, quote, "We've got an island all to ourselves. We'll take possession in the name of the king. We'll enter the service of its black inhabitants. Of course, we'll rise naturally to the top of affairs. White men always do in savage countries." By the time London encountered the racism of Spencer and his disciples, statements about racial superiority seemed far from unusual. With the tale of the South Sea voyages and the treks through the steaming jungles of Africa whirling through his brain after graduating from Cole Grammar School in Oakland, Jack London set out on some adventures of his own, following a short stint as a cannery worker. London became an oyster pirate. He then switched sides as a member of the California Fish Patrol. Years later, London constructed two juvenile novels from his experience. Though spattered with racism, London intended both The Cruise of the Dazzler, written in 1902, and Tales of the Fish Patrol, 1905, for a juvenile audience. Evidently, London wanted his boy stories to resemble those he read as a youngster. For the two novels, London drew upon his own life. The various stories he heard from other oyster pirates and patrolmen. The stories contained tales of the Fish Patrol, written in 1902, revolved around the constant struggle between London and his fellow white patrolmen and the local Chinese, Greek, and Italian fishermen. At one point in the story, London came face to face with the notorious Chinese rogue known as Yellow Handkerchief. London recalled, quote, "What was to happen next I could not imagine, for the Chinese were a different race from mine, and from what I knew, I was confident that fair play was no part of their makeup," unquote. Throughout London's life, the San Francisco Bay Area was a hotbed of anti-immigrant hostilities. The Chinese were especially targeted. The year of London's birth saw the greatest influx yet of immigrants from the Orient. In 1876, 2,200 Chinese laborers arrived in San Francisco. This added to California's total Chinese population of around 60,000. As California and the rest of the country suffered from a series of depressions, the worst of them between 1893 and 1897, unemployed white workers blamed many of their problems on the influx of cheap Chinese labor. Beginning in 1877, Dennis Kearney, the most outspoken of the early anti-Chinese advocates, appealed to the anxieties of many unemployed whites with the slogan, "The Chinese must go," unquote. Influenced by the racialist writings of Herbert Spencer and Francis Galton, others feared the contamination of the white gene pool. The Yellow Peril scare would reach a peak with London's reports from the Russia-Japanese war front in 1904. Eventually, the taste of Pacific's salty air and the promise of salaried job far from home became too enticing for him. London served as an able-bodied seaman aboard the Sophia Sutherland, a schooner bound for the rich seal-hunting waters of the Bering Sea. From January to August 1893, upon his return to the Bay Area, London published a short work of nonfiction based upon his experiences at sea. To his astonishment, quote, "Typhoon off the coast of Japan," unquote, won a first prize in a writing contest. In need of cash, he then took two odd jobs as an industrial laborer. Never content with the daily grind, London left California on a tramping expedition. Initially, London joined Coxey's army. The army, a contingent of unemployed men, pushed across the country towards Washington, D.C. When they reached Missouri, London left the group and followed his own road. During a brief sojourn in New York City, London bought books from sidewalk vendors. In an article entitled Jack London in Boston, London recalled discussing Spencer with a gentleman tramp. By the end of 1894, this tramping days behind him, London returned to Oakland with the intention of furthering his education. Back at home, London continued his unlikely friendship with Edward Applegarth, the son of a cultured middle-class family. Edward introduced London to a world he never knew. While he roamed about the U.S., the only letter London received from among his friends back in Oakland came from Edward. Subsequently, London also met and fell in love with Edward's elder sister. London's friendship with Edward proved significant in that his experience with the Applegarth family served as a basis for his novel, Martin Eden. Through London's semi-autobiographical novel, the influence Herbert Spencer's works exerted on the young London became apparent. Before London wrote Martin Eden, he reflected upon Spencer's early influence over his ideas. London wrote of Spencer, quote, "His thinking has profoundly affected me." Martin Eden told the story of a working-class seaman, not unlike the young Jack London, befriended by the college-aged son of a wealthy Oakland family. Inspired by his newly found and educated friends, Martin embarks upon a strict regimen of intense study. The first book he reads is Madame Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, 1888, attempted the fusion of Tibetan wisdom with the Western esotericism. In terms of the rise of radical racism, the book's remarkable contribution rested in Blavatsky's strange cosmology, in which the prehistoric Aryans lost their psychic powers through bestiality with inferior races. Quickly befuddled by Blavatsky's ramblings, Martin hurls the secret doctrine across his small room. In his rush for intellectual experience, Martin notes that the name Herbert Spencer being tossed about by socialist and working-class philosophers. In the City Hall Park, intrigued by the soapbox orator's devotion to Spencer, Martin began reading The First Principles, 1861. According to London, Spencer's First Principles alone, leaving out all the rest of his work, has done more for mankind than 1,000 books like Nicholas Nickleby, Hard Cash, Book of Snobs, and Uncle Tom's Cabin, just as he had done for Martin Eden. Spencer unified the worlds of biology and sociology for London into one comprehensive phrase, quote, "survival of the fittest." Though not an autobiography, Martin Eden still allowed rare insights into the early reading habits of the developing London. In addition to Blavatsky's incomprehensible The Secret Doctrine, the young Martin Eden and the young Jack London checked out of the library Thomas Bulfinch's Age of Fable, 1855, Henry George's Progress and Poverty, 1879, and Albert Shafley's The Quintessence of Socialism, 1890. After Martin Eden reading Spencer's First Principles, he, the philosopher's admirers, included such notables as Andrew Carnegie and John Fiske, but also working-class stiffs like Jack London, Richard Hofstadter, in his authority of Social Darwinism and American Thought in 1944, wrote of Spencer and his readership that he was widely read by persons who were partly or largely self-educated. Martin Eden and Jack London represented the quintessential self-educated man. At Oakland High School, London continued his lifelong slant towards self-education. Except for the publication of some of his writings in the Aegeus, the school's literary magazine, London's time there proved uneventful. As before, the fiercely independent London became bored. Instead of wasting his time, he decided to prepare for the entrance exam into the University of California before graduation. Although studying for the exams drove him to exhaustion, the university accepted London as a member of the class of 1900. But London's stay at the university was short-lived. He found many of his fellow classmates immature and the classes circumscribed. He later wrote to Anna Strunsky, quote, "One works are not treasured by a college career and record but by whole life," unquote. Searching for fortunes elsewhere, Jack London worked at a laundry for a time, deepening his interest in socialism, then succumbed to the call of adventure and headed for the Klondike. While in the Klondike, London did more reading than mining for gold. When London and James Shepherd, the husband of his sister Eliza, landed in Daya, they came face to face with their first obstacle. Before they could get to the gold, the two men had to conquer the Chilkoot Pass. Once over the pass, they successfully braved the rapids of the Miles Canyon and Box Canyon on their hand-built raft. The river was a dangerous but necessary journey if one wanted to reach the rich mining areas of the north quickly. Tired but alive, they reached the split-up island, which lay about 80 miles from Dawson. London spent the winter of 1897 in a cabin deep within the Yukon Territory, with his treasured copies of Darwin's Origins of the Species and Milton's Paradise Lost. Throughout the long winter, London expounded some on Herbert Spencer's complex theories to his captive's audience. What London did not gain in material wealth, he made up in with treasury of storylines he procured. One area of Spencer's philosophy, though not an integral part, that his followers would firmly latch onto was his warnings against miscegenation. While he encouraged intermarriage among allied varieties of the Aryan race, he vehemently forbade marriage between divergent races. Historically, Spencer stated intermarriage among allied varieties of the same race, such as the ancient Romans, with other Aryan tribes strengthened the race as a whole. When organisms widely unlike, in kind mated, no progeny can arise. In those organisms belonging to the same genus, but different species, quote, there results a mule incapability of propagating. Lastly, when remote varieties of the same species mated, a fertile offspring resulted. But subsequent generations from such a coupling resulted in infertility. In hybridized societies where the miscegenation took place, instability ruled. In his first major publication, London incorporated Spencer's message against miscegenation. After he returned from the Klondike, London began an intense writing schedule. By October 1899, London wrote 1,000 words per day, 6 days per week. One of the early fruits of the labor was the short story, The Son of the Wolf. Inspired by his own recent expedition through the Klondike, London set Son of the Wolf in the lonely expanses of the Northland. With the lack of white females in the area, Scruff McKenzie, a white prospector, cast his gaze upon a comely Indian girl who came close to the white man's type of beauty. The evils of miscegenation were not brought up by another white man, but by the tribe's chief. London's use of the non-white herald for racial purity, usually an Indian chief, he notably resurrected in his last completed work, Hearts of Three, in 1920. The Indian chief in The Son of the Wolf, who was also the girl's father, unquestionably forbids the marriage of his daughter to a white man, though Mackenzie proves himself the mightiest hunter, intellectually superior, and the fittest for survival, the chief remains unimpressed. Quote, O white man, whom we have named the wolf, the chief says, we know thou comest of a mighty race. We are proud to have thee our potlatch guest, but the king salmon does not mate with the dog salmon, nor the raven with the wolf. Unquote. Using Spencer's model, London chose two organisms, the king salmon and the dog salmon. Both belong to the same genus, but are different species, with the raven, which represents the Indian race, and the wolf, which represents the white race. London chose two organisms not even in the same phylum. Both examples were designed as metaphors against miscegenation. Spencer used the same animal analogies. He strongly dissuaded coupling among widely divergent organisms such as the raven and the wolf, but also between similar varieties like the king and the dog salmon. Proclamations against miscegenation were also made, again by an Indian in the Quiche, the son of Quiche, around the fire of Nob. Quiche, a neighboring Indian chief, bids for the hand of Gob's daughter. Gob refuses to give his daughter to a Quiche, for Quiche allowed the women of his village to marry white men. When Quiche approaches Susu, Gob's sister, she also spurns him. Susu says to Quiche, it so happens that the fish of the water and the beasts of the forest bring forth after their own kind. Likewise, it happens with women. Here, London combines Spencer with the Bible. London read in the book of Genesis, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kind, just as the Indian chief in The Son of the Wolf says to Mackenzie, it were evil mating, like the water with the sand. London reinforced not only the genetic unfeasibility of miscegenation, but its moral ramifications. To mate outside one's kind was to go against the primal laws of nature. It's my belief at this late date is that capitalism and religion and distorted nationalism combined to really ruin the racial concept and the basic racial beliefs. And it's getting worse every day with the combination of these three. And I think that Hitler's misuse of the racial ideas screwed things really up, because racism was going along just fine prior to World War II. But after World War II, it was going really bad, and it's been going bad ever since. Well, anyhow, let me read a little more here. The problems of miscegenation reappeared during London's aborted round-the-world cruise in December 1907 with Charmian, his second wife. London dropped anchor at the port of Nuka Hiva in the Marquesa Islands. During the sail down from Hawaii, London read aloud from Caleb Williams Celebes' The Cycle of Life, printed in 1904. A Scottish-born medical doctor, author, and follower of Spencer, Salibi discussed such diverse topics in his book as Swimming, The Evidence for Telepathy, and The Future of the Mongol. On the subject of miscegenation, Salibi advised against the admixture of races too diverse, unquote. Salibi found support for his position in Spencer. Spencer wrote a series of letters to Kaneko Kentaro, a Japanese cabinet minister, in 1892. Remarkably, Salibi reprinted a large excerpt from one of those letters in his book. Salibi quoted, "There is an abundant proof alike furnished by the intermarriages of human races and the interbreeding of animals that when the varieties mingle diverse beyond a certain slight degree, the result is inevitably a bad one in the long run." Once more, Spencer aligned human with animal breeding. Happenstance found Spencer writing his letter to Kentaro during a visit with an expert in animal husbandry. In his conversation with the animal breeder, which Spencer related in his letter, Spencer further confirmed his opinions. When different varieties of sheep and other cattle mated, according to the animal breeder, the result was an incalculable mixture of traits and a chaotic constitution. Spencer then asserted that the same thing happened to humans. In the course of the generations, the races acquired certain inherited traits suited for their particular environments. The progeny of the two divergent varieties inherited neither the father nor the mother's survival traits. The products of interracial mating inherited a useless constitution which will not work properly because it is not fitted for any set of conditions. The day before London sighted the Marquesas Islands, December 5, 1907, he completed the cycle of life. With Spencer's letter freshly imprinted on his brain, London found the Marquesian people far removed from the descriptions he read in Herman Melville's Typee, written in 1892. When he reached the islands, London waxed nostalgically about his boyhood love of Melville's South Seas Adventure novel. The setting for Melville's novel was the glorious flower-filled valley of Typee, populated with beautiful childlike natives. What London found in the valley smashed his romantic illusions. On borrowed horses, London and Charmian discovered a virtual deserted Typee. The once glorious village was covered in jungle overgrowth. The happy and healthy Marquesians of Melville's time had also disappeared. The few Marquesians left on the island seemed pleasant enough to London, but physically unhealthy. To his consternation, despite the warm, equitable clime, the Marquesians exhibited a variety of ailments. London placed the blame on their current situation on miscegenation. Of the Marquesian population, London wrote, "A pure Marquesian is a rarity. They seem to be all half-breeds and strange conglomerations of dozens of different races. In their veins runs the blood of English, American, Dane, German, French, Corsican, Spanish, Portuguese, Chinese, Hawaiian, Pomotan, Tahitian, and Easter Islander." For London, Spencer's letter came to fruition. Just as Spencer predicted, the mixture of divergent varieties resulted in a sickly, unadaptable individuals. The constant infusion of new blood, London remarked, only delayed the inevitable. With their inherited constitutions suited for nowhere, the mixed genetics of the Marquesians doomed their race. From every hut, London heard the hideous gasps and chokes of a dying race. From 1899 to 1902, London maintained an intense correspondence with Caldesley Johns. After reading, quote, to the man on the trail and the white silence in the Overland Monthly. In February 1899, Johns wrote to London of his admiration. Through the mail, the two quickly became devoted friends. For about 4 years, they wrote almost daily to each other. The subject they discussed in their letters included current events and their favorite books, Herbert Spencer, and racial theories. In one such letter, London wrote, "Mind you, we must come to an understanding that nature has no sentiment, no charity, no mercy. We are blind puppets at the play of great unreasoning forces. Yet we may come to know the laws of some of the forces and see our trend in relation to them. These forces generated the altruistic in man, the race. With the highest altruism will endure, the highest altruism considered from the standpoint of merciless natural law, which never concedes nor alters. The lesser breeds cannot endure. The Indian is an example, as is the black man of the Australian bush, the South Sea Islander, and the inhabitants of the sub-Arctics, and so on." London's racial altruism directly stemmed from Spencer's Study of Sociology, 1874. Both London and Spencer adapted an altruistic sensibility to accommodate their social Darwinist survival of the fittest mentality. Spencer described unqualified altruism as absurd. Altruism towards inferior human varieties, including those of the white race, disrupted the evolutionary process by allowing the genetically feeble the opportunity to propagate. London referred to this process as the weeding out, the clarifying of the race. London's words are all the more haunting when compared to those of Spencer. Quote, "Inconvenience, suffering, and death are penalties attached by nature to ignorance as well as incompetence, are also the means of remedying these, partly by weeding out those of lowest development, and partly by subjecting those who remain to never-ceasing discipline of experience. Nature secures the growth of a race, who shall both understand the conditions of existence and be able to act upon them." London's racial altruism reappears in his socialist theories and in his views regarding the poor of all races in his essay, What Communities Lose by the Competitive System. Written in 1900, London wrote, "The forces of evolution affecting their ends under various guises are, after all, one and the same in principle. Even though the urban jungle replaced the tiger in the bush, the results were the same. The clarifying of the race." In another letter to Johns, London described socialism as an ideal system devised for the happiness of a certain kindred races. In 1914, London surprised the U.S. socialist when he returned from covering the Mexican Revolution and proposed the establishment of a race-based patriarchal system in that country. With regards to the poor, London saw the working class of the British capital as a genetically doomed population. For London, the strength of the English-speaking race today is not in the tight little island, but in the new world overseas. Those that remained in the motherland survived because they possessed a capacity of adaptation to the degradation which they are surrounded. In the industrial world, natural selection had not disappeared. It just took on new forms. The Spencerian Martin Eden felt the same. Martin believes the child of the overcrowded ghetto, the unfit, because they are weak. Nature rejects them. London's acceptance of the cruel laws of nature did not stop him from feeling sympathy for the conditions of the poor, but London learned from Spencer how adaptation and race maintenance were connected. Those who could adapt to hostile conditions lived to pass on their seed. Those who could not did not. Spencer's direct influence upon London's writing appeared prominently in the London's first novel, A Daughter of the Snows, written in 1902, and his best-known work, The Call of the Wild. Both books dealt directly with the importance of heredity and how genetic inheritance determined the chance of survival. In A Daughter of the Snows, London transplanted the mind of Spencer into the body of a woman, Frona Wells, like a Valkyrie, pulled from the pages of De Chaillu's The Viking Age, 1889, stomped through the freezing mud of the Klondike spouting racial theories of white supremacy. The white man is the greatest and the best breed in the world. Take the Indian, for instance. The white man comes along and beats him at all his games, outworks him, outhunts him. In John Barleycorn, 1913, London describes his trek over the Chilkoot Pass in a similar fashion. Quote, I was packing up with the Indians and outpacking many an Indian. While not engaged in the dispersion of racial dogma, Frona bests many of the men she hikes, swims, and canoes her way through the series of adventures. In the midst of writing the first chapter, London wrote to Cloudesley, John's concerning his progress on the book, his interest in physical culture, and that he intended to assimilate Spencer's philosophy in education, intellectual, moral, physical. Spencer lambasted women who forsook the development of their body in the favor of the development of their mind. According to Spencer, men care comparatively little about erudition in women, but very much for the physical beauty and good nature and good sense. The greatest coupling came from those drawn together by physical attractions and the weakest by intellectual attractions. Only through the cultivation of physical strength and wellness could superior descendants be promulgated. London created Frona Wells as the first perfect racial specimen. In his future works, London continued the connection between racial superiority and physical perfection. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I hope I don't bore you with this, but I think it's stuff you need to know, that real racial research and thinking came long before 1930. But it got distorted. It got off the track. And the farther they went into the extremity of capitalism and nationalism and religion, the more they screwed up the racial theory of Spencer and Jack London. So that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday, and we'll see what else we can dig up here. I may continue with this reading, or I may not. 14.5. Remember, I have nothing to say. And that's why he who runs alone runs the fastest. These guys, they write me all the time for prison. They're getting out of prison, and they want to know who to get together with. And I tell them, don't get together with anybody. Get together with yourself, the lone wolf. Don't be drug into a bunch of people who are already failures and have failed before. You got to improve yourself. And by coming out of prison and going back into the same type of group, you're screwing yourself. You'll probably end up back in prison. Bye-bye.
Millions of dead as long as die.
Your leaders are bigots.
It's the Pope wars on the Catholic Emperor.
Your generals are bandits.
Wars on the Catholic King of France.
You employ any mercenary you can get.
Wars on the Catholic King of Spain.
And the Pope plays politics, helped by 100 other princes, kings, bishops.
All for their own rotten purposes.
All sides are rotten, except for people like you. Religious fanatics who incite murder for the sake of a god they have never known. Don't you understand? There is no god!